Hello from the Talking Information Center, and welcome to The Poet's Voice, a program supported by America's Hometown Laureates Incorporated and dedicated to the place of poetry in our lives and communities. Today, Marshfield poet Mark Walsh, that's me, will interview Pembroke poet Elaine Sorrentino. Our poems have appeared in numerous print and online journals. In the last year, we've each published our first collection of poems, mine called In the Garden of Fortunes, and Elaine's called Belly Dancing in a Brown Sweatsuit. We both have more poetry in progress. Elaine is a communications director at South Shore Conservatory in Hingham and Duxbury, and is the facilitator of the Duxbury Poetry Circle and at the Duxbury Free Library. Today, I'll be talking with Elaine about her insights and influences concerning poetry, and we'll hear her read one of her poems. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you.
To get us started, here's Elaine reading one of her poems.
Thanks, Mark. This piece is called Blessings from the Char. After flames licked the walls, danced up the stairs in a fiery tango of devastation, engulfed their vacant beds, a grateful community wrapped them in a shawl of compassion. Memories and milestones, teddy bears and Timberlands obliterated by the winter blaze that spared the donation shed, where for years they collected essentials to help those in crisis. When fate turned the tables, past recipients of rice, diapers, boots, placed their own feet in these scorched shoes, surrendering hard-earned greenbacks to ensure their benefactors had food in their bellies, clothing on their backs, and a place to throw their bones down. This family never expected anything in return. More than happy to help a neighbor.
Mm. Place their own feet in their scorched shoes. I love that line. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
So, Elaine, just to start, could you tell us what's your process for writing a poem? And could you give us an idea of how this poem came to be?
This poem is actually an acrostic poem, which means mm-hmm. it was inspired by a piece of artwork.
Yes.
And in this case, it was Hanover artist Jim Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
He had done this sculpture that looked like a piece of burnt wood.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it, and all I could think of was in 2016, my stepson and his family, they lost their home in a fire.
Oh, okay.
So I wanted to write about that, but I didn't want to write about the tragedy of it.
Mm.
I wanted to write about the goodness that came out of it,
yeah.
the kindness
yeah.
that came out of it, which
right.
was really astounding. So my process for writing, it's, I don't know whether I would call it a process. Words sort of follow me around.
Yep.
They come when I'm driving in the car. They come when I'm brushing my teeth, when I'm mm-hmm. putting on makeup.
Right.
And as they come, I write them down, email them to myself, text them to myself. And because I work full time, I don't have time every day to sit down
right.
and to dedicate to it.
Right.
So my time is on the weekend
mm-hmm.
and it's usually on a Sunday. I will take those little pieces of the poem that have come in and try to put them together. At the same time, I have my television going. Food Network is usually on every Sunday. I've got my computer, and I usually have a jigsaw puzzle going because I find that it gets me unstuck.
Yeah.
So I'll work on it. I would say that I probably worked on this maybe two or three sittings before I felt that
right.
I wanted to share it. I always share with a second reader.
Yeah.
Because it's important. Other
mm-hmm.
people see things that you don't see in
Absolutely.
Your poem. And for me, that second reader is almost always my cousin who is out in Washington.
Okay.
We trade critiques back and
yep.
forth. We usually say something like, these are just grains of salt. Take what you want. Leave the rest.
That's
so,
great.
But having that second read always makes the poem stronger.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I absolutely agree. And that sounds like a process that you have developed and worked out that fits where you are in your life right now. Like you said, you're working full time. You don't get a chance to look at the poetry every day, but you carve out specific times during the weekend. So I would say that's an effective process. Could you tell us, going back to the beginning, how did you get into poetry?
I've only been writing poetry probably for the last 10 years, mm-hmm. but I've been a writer my entire life. I have a journalism degree.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of my life telling other people's stories.
Right.
So maybe about 12 years ago, I decided that I wanted to do some memoir writing.
Mm-hmm.
My two boys, there's probably a lot of parts of my life that have never come up. Things
yeah.
that you really don't discuss with your kids
on sure.
because they're embarrassing or anything. They
right.
just don't come up.
Right.
So I started writing memoir with a group in Marshfield.
Okay.
But 2 years into it, my aunt passed away. She lived up in New Hampshire, and she was a poet, although she never would have called herself a poet because
right.
I could actually only find one piece that was actually published.
Yeah.
And I used to say that she was born 40 years too early because we can get our words out into the universe a lot easier.
Very true.
Today,
very, very
you
true.
Know, hers was pen and paper.
Mm-hmm.
You send a self-addressed stamped envelope with your manuscript and they send you back with their rejection or or a check. I'm not sure she got money. But anyway, my mom inherited her house, and when we were cleaning the house out for sale, we found bits of her poetry. She didn't put it formally anywhere. She used
yeah.
to recite it.
Mm-hmm.
We found it in drawers. We found it in notebooks. We found it tucked in cookbooks. It
yep.
was just everywhere. And there was a substantial amount. So what I did was I took all of the ones that I felt were finished. I didn't want to put any words in her mouth.
Right.
I put them into iBooks for her family and
oh.
sent it out to
oh, that's great.
Siblings and nieces and nephews.
Yep.
And just the process of doing that, watching how she took little snapshots of her life
mm-hmm.
and wrote about them, made me realize that that is the way I would like to tell my story,
uh-huh.
just in these
yeah.
little snapshots. You don't have to have a full manuscript.
Right, right,
so.
Right. But I love that you came to poetry, but at the same time, you had been in a writer's life for quite some time. So, you know, you were drawn to language. And it evolved over time. It was in the form of journalism when you first started, but then with the discovery of all your aunt's work, then it translates over. So yeah, that's really, really interesting. If I were to ask you what's the most important piece of advice that was given to you about poetry and writing poetry, what would you have to say about that?
I've gotten a lot of advice. I've learned a lot about poetry, mostly that there are no rules. But
right.
the most valuable pieces of information I got came from Lilly Poetry Review editor Eileen Clary,
mm-hmm.
who graciously spent some time with me to edit Belly Dancing in a sweatsuit,
yeah.
in a bronze sweatsuit. She gave me, she knew what my background was, and she knew where my head went to, like, tell the whole story, because
right.
that was what I was trained to do.
Right.
And she said to me three things. She said, stay in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Don't wrap your poems up with a bow, which was absolutely what I was I tended to do,
yeah.
because that's what I was used to.
Yeah.
And leave some blanks for the readers to fill in.
Right.
Let them come to their own conclusions at
mm-hmm.
some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like that advice. And yeah, she is an exceptional editor. And there's a, you know, the fact that she gave you that advice that speaks right to you is so vital. So it's almost as if she has this sixth sense to sort of know exactly what you need and what you need to hear. Cause I had a similar experience with her when I was editing my book, and the things that she said were just like, yes, yes, exactly, Eileen. That's exactly what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
So she's something else. She's really, really special.
Yeah. She's a wonderful editor and very, very generous of her
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
So I thought I would read a piece that she helped me edit. It's,
absolutely.
I would say it is probably only half the length it started out being,
mm-hmm.
and I like it so much better. It's much stronger. This poem is called Imitation, and it may or may not be about my husband.
Okay.
Imitation. Shirtless, barefoot, slathered in sunblock, he stands, rod in hand, at the end of the dock, drinking in the pine smell, reminiscent of carefree summer days at Boy Scout camp. casting and reeling, reeling and casting, until he snags a largemouth bass and sets it free, then searches his clunky metal fishing box for a lure devoid of hooks and secures it to the pole so he can continue fishing without interruption.
Mm, that's great. I love the callback to the memory of his childhood and drinking in the pine air. That's great. Now, you mentioned, if I could just ask a quick follow-up question, that the poem was longer.
Yes.
Was it like considerably longer? Because that was like a three stanza poem, right?
It was. Yeah. And it actually published on Wilda Morris's Blogspot.
Oh, okay.
I would say it was twice as long.
Yeah. Yeah. And Eileen was recommending that you cut, you know, at least by half. Initially, how did you feel about that? Because that's a big cut.
Yeah. They talk about killing your darlings.
Yeah, exactly.
She didn't actually get it down to this. What she
right.
said is look at it and decide if you need it.
Right.
And in the end, when Eileen was no longer there, I'm
yep.
thinking that I cut maybe even more than she suggested.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
keeping in her head her yeah. suggestions.
Right.
It was so helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. I had a similar experience working with her, and some of the poems were cut down to like one line, and then I would take a look and say, yeah, no, that's right. That expresses everything I needed to say in that one line. It's a little jarring in the beginning, but then when you step back and take a look at it, you say, yeah, anything that didn't need to be there is gone. And it's just that expression right there, and that just works lovely.
Yeah, poetry yeah. is getting it down to its most naked.
Exactly.
to get
exactly.
your point across.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
100%. Yeah, and it's hard work, but that's what we have to do. Elaine, who would you say would be your greatest poetic influence in your writing? So, like, you know, who would be your go-to poet?
Well, if you had asked me this when I started writing, I would say that Kathleen Sheeta Bonanno was my greatest influence. I would say that, anyway, I'll tell you a little bit about her book and you'll understand.
Yeah.
She wrote this book called Slamming Open the Door, and it's actually a poetic sequence about she was a mom whose 21-year-old daughter had been murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And the poems in it they're very tender and heartbreaking, but it's very poetic the way she tells her story,
yeah.
the way a journalist would tell a story,
mm-hmm.
but in verse. And
right.
I would say that influenced me because it made me realize I can do this. If
yes.
she can do it about such a difficult topic, I can
right.
do it about
right.
eating lobster with my grandfather, you know. But since then, I just love Andrea Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote this piece called Mega Hat in the Chemo Room. And having gone through chemo myself,
yeah.
That's not a place for a political statement. That's a place for healing
right.
and support.
Right.
So I love their work. I love Billy Collins.
Mm-hmm.
I love the humor that he
mm-hmm.
uses to tell the story.
Yeah.
I use a lot of humor in my poetry and in my life. It's how
yeah.
I get through difficult times.
Yep.
I love Plymouth poet Dean Kreling, who
yeah.
teaches me a lot about
yeah.
formalist
yeah,
poetry.
She's great.
Yep. And Marshall poet Zvenia Orlowski, who is a fellow breast cancer survivor,
mm-hmm.
And she has written a lot about it. And together, Zvenia and I have put together a program called Pink Lemonade.
Okay.
And it's art, poetry and art inspired by breast cancer.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. That's fantastic.
So, yeah, we will be presenting that. Our second presentation will be in October during Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Do you hope, if I could just follow up with that, do you hope to produce a collection of poetry from that, or like an anthology, or is it just a reading series? Or
there is talk about that something
yeah.
might come out of it. The very first one that we did was back in 2019.
Right.
And then, of course, because of COVID and all the things that came between them, we weren't able to do it until now. But
right.
There's a lot of beautiful, beautiful pieces out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm familiar with some of her poetry around breast cancer in her most recent collection of poetry, and it is it's sobering, but at the same time, she never loses sight of the humor in that. And I think that that's something that's really important too. Having gone through that with my mother, who had breast cancer for a number of years, it was really a relief to find that there could be so much humor around it from folks at the Dana-Farber, or just kind of like how my mom would look at it at times. So yeah, to give it a full, well-rounded look, I think that's a really important thing. That's fantastic. So my final question for you today is, if you could, in relation to your collection, Belly Dancing in a Brown Suit, which is, let me say, title, awesome, crushed it. I think that's fantastic. Could you just tell us about the process of compiling that first collection of poetry?
I actually hadn't thought about, in 2019, when I did my first public reading, I hadn't thought about compiling a book. I was brand new at this. I might have maybe had 12 poems. No, maybe 20 poems published by then, but not enough for a collection. Mm-hmm. So I was at the Marshfield Library doing a reading, and I did a piece called The Rapi Cha-Cha.
Okay.
And it's a story about my French-Canadian parents in the kitchen, and they're making rapi pie, which is a French-Canadian traditional dish.
Okay.
It's arduous. There's a lot of steps to it. Yeah. So at the end of that reading, this woman came up to me and she said, oh my God, she said, I'm French Canadian. My parents did the same thing in their kitchen.
Yeah.
Do you have a book? I'd like to keep that poem.
Right.
And of course, I didn't have a book, so I ripped it out of my notebook and I gave it to her. But she planted that seed that maybe there was a book in my future. And it took me 5 years to put it together because, again, I was new. I still consider myself new. I'm learning every day. Mm-hmm. I love what the book became after 5 years.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what should be my first poem, what should be my last poem. I needed a roadmap of sorts.
Right.
So I had written this poem called Before and After, and when it published on Lothlorien Journal, I said to myself, I think this is my roadmap. Mm-hmm. So anything that fell in a before or an after would fit in it. And there was one poem that I wrote that I really love called Spring Wannabe, and it was a personification poem, and it just didn't fit in. It didn't make the cut, but it helped me decide what would stay and what would go.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, it's sort of in chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just all very personal pieces.
Right. That's lovely. A Lothlorien Journal. What was the name of that again? You're speaking my language there with that, Elaine. You're speaking my language big time. I really am interested in what you were saying there, that, you know, this took you 5 years. And I think that that's really important, to give yourself that time so you're not, you know, rushing to put it together for the sake of putting a collection together to start to move on something. You felt that it needed time maybe to, you know, revise poems, add new poems in and things like that. So did you give yourself any sort of pressure? It's kind of like, I got to get this done and a manuscript together and out. Or did you say, I'm just going to let this be what it is and just take its own time to come together?
I waited until I loved every piece in it. And then I said, okay, now I'm ready to present this.
That's fantastic. I think that's a really good marker for that metric to do a collection. Well, speaking of which, we've got a couple minutes left here. So I'd love to hear some of your poetry from the book, or if there's other poems you'd like to read, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, I thought I would start out with my before and after poem, just to give you an idea of what this roadmap sounded like.
Okay.
This is before and after. My life is measured in befores and afters. Before slimming down, I was a kind, jocular, footloose teen. After, I was self-aware, guarded, judgmental. Before marrying the wrong man, I romanticized married life. After, I embraced solitude. Before children, New Year's Eve was about partying. After, New Year's Eve was about staying safe. Hmm. Before divorce, the ocean washed my home away. After, Home was anywhere my children were. Before my dad died, life was carefree and celebrated. After, the plane hit the building. Before, my forever man, perfect marriage was a fairy tale. After, I was loved unconditionally. Before cancer, I was undone by mean emails. After, I pressed delete.
That's fantastic. That poem, if I just going to cut in that, it put me in mind of Mark Twain's two ways of looking at a river and the difference between, you know, innocence and experience, that before you, you know, you've gone through a certain moment in life, and then after you've gone through a moment in life, and there was this innocent wisdom balance that was going through that poem. That was just great.
Thank you. It was a really good roadmap for me.
Yes, absolutely.
It helped a lot.
Yeah.
I was going to start out with a couple that are not in the book, but poems that I like. This one is called Black Sheep. We spend a lot of time in our backyard watching wildlife, and this is about baby turkeys. So it's called Black Sheep. One of three poults, he spurred our sympathy with his nightly limp across the lawn, always the last in a chorus of five. We found his challenge endearing, his mother's patience merciful as she hung back while siblings romped free, splashed in the creek, and chased each other through grass and field. We hardly recognized him soaring into our yard months later, fully grown, still hobbling, a solo act this time, no sibling or parent by his side, thriving despite the odds.
That's great. We lived one town over from each other, so that those could be the same turkeys.
They could be the same
could
turkeys.
Be in my yard too.
We love that turkey. This next one, this is the last one I'll do that's not in the book. It's called Liturgical Folk.
Okay.
I had been a liturgical folk singer for 20 years. I sang in Braintree, Dorchester, and Scituate because it fed my soul.
Sure.
This is Liturgical Folk. Harmony creeps like slow, silent ripples, a stone dropped in water, peaceful as a slumbering child, or first steps towards reconciliation. It is the release of anxiety at a friend's funeral, when the mind's desire to be the musical calming force conflicts with the uncertain heart. Can you deliver? It's the answer to petitions, the wave which sweeps your binging. Head-to-toe tranquility, God's comfort and assurance that ensuing notes escape, soulful, melodious, and pure.
That was lovely.
Thank you. I think I will read the title poem, Belly Dancing in a Brown Sweatsuit. And I can tell you where it came from was the first time I went through breast cancer, I went through 9 months of treatment, and I was ready for something fun.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So I went up to the high school. I said, what do you have for adult dance classes? And I thought they would say tap or country line dancing or something. But no, they had belly dancing. So there I was in my brown sweatsuit.
Right.
And by the way, I was really bad. Here we go. Belly dancing in a brown sweatsuit. The suit, chocolate colored, more milk than dark, with a light aqua line racing up the leg. My little pop of femininity in otherwise masculine attire for an activity designed to make one feel vibrant and sexy after 9 months of treatment. They said, wear comfy clothing. The instructor, dark-haired, exotic, energetic, smiles as she greets the class while donning her multicolored hip scarf, starts shimmying her torso, her percussive movements rewarded with a jingling at every thrust, ends with tiny hip vibrations, then coaxes her wide-eyed 40-somethings. Okay, ladies, now you try. We configure ourselves in a line dancing pattern and mimic her gyrations, uncertain how to make our hips snap. Ridiculous and clumsy, as she urges, let me show you again. The rebellion. The women stand unsmiling, arms crossed, resembling a row of angry Mr. Cleans, but with hair. They refuse to try it again, insisting they'd rather watch her dance. All except for me, the brown-suited belly dancer, who'd already spent too much time on the sidelines. I'll give it a go. The solo. As I shove my stiff arms to the side like a department store mannequin and move my hips, I hear laughter behind me, very satisfying, a preferable alternative to surgery, infusions, and radiation. And I'm happy to provide the amusement. I didn't come to watch.
That was delightful. That was so affirming and at the same time playful and just absolutely lovely.
Thank you.
Those were great. That was a great collection of poems that you shared tonight, Elaine. Thank you so much. And thank you, Elaine, once again, for sharing your work and your take on the Poet's Voice. And thanks to our audience for joining us. Listeners, if you'd like to follow our program, remember to check your TIC listings for future broadcasts of the Poet's Voice. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.